Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This is Internet Marketing.
Hello and welcome to the Internet Marketing Podcast brought to you by Site Visibility. I'm your host, Scott Colnut, and with me today is Skylar Reeves, CEO of Ardent Growth. Skylar, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
I'm excited about this topic. I'll give you a quick story and a little bit of insight into my background. So 10, 12 years ago, when I first became aware of the discipline SEO, I joined an agency. And one of my first jobs, I was sat in front of a computer, given an Excel spreadsheet with hundreds of tabs. And maybe, I think the project was 100,000 keywords. And I'd never experienced SEO or been in this kind of environment before. Someone basically instructed and taught me how to theme and group keywords in Excel. But back then, the person that taught me was lovely, but they weren't particularly experienced in Excel. We didn't maybe have sentiment and AI to work with in the same way. So a lot of it was manual. But what it did give me is it gave me a real foundation in SEO, which I think really benefited me in the rest of my career. And the process for me gave me such clarity and exposure to what people search for. I've always had kind of an affinity with topic clustering, keyword research, and that aspect of SEO. That's a little bit about my story with SEO and topic clustering in particular, but I want to know a bit about yours. So where did topic clustering come onto your radar in your career?
So it actually goes back a few years. My background's in computer science, and topic clustering from a graph theory standpoint is very different from the way that I think SEOs and marketers sort of think about it, but they do have some overlap. But I think in the marketing side of things, it was, as we were trying to plan out content for customers that we were working with, and, we read, 2017 when Matthew Barbie and some folks over at HubSpot published that article on HubSpot about the topic clusters and the hub and spoke model. And I remember thinking as we were trying to implement this ourselves that, hey, this sounds good, but like, how do you do it? And, and how do you know that you're right? That was sort of the key thing for me. And sometimes I think one of my downfalls is, coming from that sort of computer science background, we're always trying to back things up with data and come up with, solutions and algorithms that can scale predictably. So doing it manually was, kind of a pain and time consuming. And it was a lot of times just relying on your gut instinct. And I didn't like that. So decided to sit down in front of the chalkboard took about a month or so to kind of work out all the math that we needed to do to be able to process the data at scale and how we wanted to kind of group things together from in our graphs, wrote up the math, and we built an algorithm to go solve it. So,
and in your current environment, so this is already quite interesting to me because I've been in environments where data scientists are responsible for topic clustering. Sometimes a content marketer might be left to do it. Sometimes you get just marketing generalists that have this as one aspect of their role. In your environment you're in right now, who's responsible for topic clustering?
now that we have a tool for it, it's fairly straightforward because we built a front end interface for it. Most of the people here, there's a handful of engineers, but then we have a lot of, you know, standard growth marketers and content marketers and things like that. So we built a front end interface for them. So they'll handle the keyword research. They'll collect all the data that they want to feed into the algorithm. But then the algorithm handles it for them. One thing I think that's worth noting is that there's a bit of semantics, I think, that have to be unwrapped here a bit. So when we're talking about topic clusters or a hub or a spoke or a keyword or anything like that, there's some ambiguity between terms. And I think that what we're really doing, like if we want to talk about this from the way it's like would be phrased in from a graph theory standpoint, is actually just grouping. It's not actual clustering. A clustering is just when you take two nodes in a graph and connect them together with some edge between them. So if these were pages on the web, it'd be two pages with an internal link or something, right? But when you're doing it with words and phrases, it's not quite the same thing. And if we were to think about the way HubSpot talks about the hub and the spoke model, it's somewhat different because you can't algorithmically predict what hubs are going to be because that's entirely dependent upon your business model, you know, how you actually want to group these things together. But from a semantic standpoint and from an intent standpoint, you certainly can. And, you know, you can kind of rely on Google to do that. So again, just one thing I want to kind of make clear is that what you're doing is you're taking topics, grouping them together. But then your actual hubs, right, are really dependent on like, what are you trying to accomplish as a business? And you have to kind of figure those out from a top-down standpoint of what are your products, who do you serve, where you position it in the market, et cetera. But to reiterate it though, most of the clustering is just handled by the algorithm itself now. And we let strategists handle the keyword research and then feed it into our interface.
So for anyone listening that maybe hasn't been exposed to topic clustering and some of these processes that we're talking about here, from your perspective, what does topic clustering help you achieve as a marketer, as a business person, or just as a business?
So the primary thing that it solves for us is, I mean, ultimately it's driving revenue, but that's because when we cluster things appropriately on the site, we can rank better, right? We can rank faster. We can help Google understand what the page is about. And that's ultimately, I think, what a lot of people overlook when it comes to things like search engine optimization is that your number one goal is just to make it where Google can understand what you're trying to tell it. From a pure SEO standpoint, now there are other factors that go into that too, like UX, and it's ultimately for the reader or the customer. But when you're trying to tell the algorithm something, you need to tell Google's algorithm, hey, this is what this page is about. Remove the ambiguity, make it very clear for it so it doesn't second guess itself as it's trying to index you and rank you. And do we need to make one page or do we need to make two, which helps save resources? That way you're not spending budget creating multiple pages when you really could have just captured all the rankings for those terms and brought in that traffic to your website with just a single page.
For anyone that's familiar with the hub and spoke model and the more manual or semi-automated methods of topic clustering, can you describe the differences between the software that you've built and particularly the algorithm that drives the software and the clustering in comparison to what people are trying to do manually?
So when you try to do it manually, I've seen two approaches to this that people have taken. One of them is they'll take all this keyword data and they'll begin to sort of add qualitative coding to it like you would do with any sort of qualitative research, you know, where you'll say, okay, I've got all these, I'm going to kind of work out my own themes that I'm seeing here. And a lot of it becomes based on gut instinct. And that's not only takes a while, but it's also not really based in any sort of data outside of your gut. And so if you take, you know, three different people and have them code that same data, you're going to end up with three different data sets. The other way though, that I've seen people do it is let's say you take two topics. I think one of the examples that we talked about in the past was, if you take a topic like project management software and project management tools, and you look at them side by side on Google, what you want to see is, you know, is the intent the same? And from an initial kind of glance over, when you just look at the two keywords themselves, you would think, oh, well, yeah, they're the same thing. Tools, software, you know, are synonym for what the user's wanting. And they are from a user's perspective, but they're not really from Google's perspective. So if you were to look at the two search results side by side, you'll see that Google's ranking different pages for each of those terms. And so what you can do is you can take your set of keywords, put them side by side in Google, and you want to look to see what's the degree of overlap. What URLs are Google ranking for this keyword A versus keyword B? And if they have a high degree of overlap, then that's Google's way of telling you, or what you can infer from that is that if one page can rank for both keywords, then a single page on your site can rank for both keywords as well. But if you see either a large disparity between the URLs that are actually ranking, or if you see that the URLs that are ranking, say, in the top one, two, or three positions for keyword A are ranking, you know, in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th positions, whatever, for keyword B, then that's also a signal that you can separate out those two topics. So I've seen people do it that way as well, but you can imagine when you're trying to do that on a very large data set, that that is very, very time consuming.
If I've understood that correctly, then the key benefit to the software that you've built, or one of the key benefits, is the ability to distinguish the overlap or the intent between different keywords.
Yeah, exactly.
You were touching on it there at the end in terms of doing this at scale. So again, I expect a lot of people listening to this have done keyword research manually, maybe at a page or a category level on a website. But when you talk about doing this at scale, what kind of data sets are we talking about? What's the number of keywords that you're able to analyze?
I think the largest set that we've looked at thus far was somewhere around like 4 million different keywords. We can do as many as theoretically possible, but the larger that your TAM is, and like the more horizontal your business model is, the more keywords that you would want to feed in this thing. Something to note though too is even when you're working in a very small niche, like let's say you were just a project management app, for example. When you go to Google, or when you go to, let's say you go into a tool like Ahrefs, a keyword research tool, right? And you say, give me every single topic related to project management. There's a lot of keywords you're going to get back. I think it's close to 300,000. And that's just one single topic, right? So you can imagine if you're a project management, like if you're a software company that produces a project management software or whatever, then you're going to have project management. You're going to have all the keywords related to Gantt charts, task management, productivity, time tracking, et cetera, right? And when you begin to aggregate all of these up, it's, you know, these become very large data sets. And not that you have to process all that data, but we like to, because we want to understand when we're going to create a page, what's the total value that that page could potentially drive for us? And there's a ton of keywords, right, that are very long tail, low search volume, but can drive a lot of revenue. And when you just kind of focus at the, you know, the high volume kind of seed type terms, right, the core sort of ideas, you miss out on a lot of that richness of not only from, you know, you address that in your content, you can rank those terms and drive revenue, but also when you're actually analyzing the data, being able to see all those variations of questions and phrases, right, that can also get paired along with a short tail term, really helps you understand more about what that page needs to be about. So we tend to do it for, I'd say, like normal sizes, anywhere between, if it's for one topic, it's probably like 50,000 to 500,000. But if we're doing it for an entire industry, it quickly begins to increase.
Visualizing the process here, and I can understand a little bit more about how your software helps to cluster keywords. And then you're still left, though, with a large amount of data. So you're still left with potentially hundreds or thousands, depending on, again, the size of the industry or sector that you're looking at. But, you know, still hundreds or thousands of topic clusters potentially. And you mentioned before that, I think you said there's someone in your business, a role like a keyword strategist or content strategist. How do they then take that information and prioritize it? So what's your approach to prioritization?
We built a formula for that too, because that was the, once we actually solved the first problem of being able to cluster things together at scale, we were like, great, now what? You know, and we're just sitting there looking at this massive amount of data, and we're like, all right, we have to figure out a way to be able to take action on this. And so the place where you start, though, is you start by saying, okay, like, what are the goals of the business, right? So you have to, like, think about the business strategy, and then, because content strategy is a subset of the business strategy. It's a subset of marketing strategy, which is a subset of business strategy, right? So you kind of have to work your way down from the business strategy first to get down to the content strategy and say, okay, what are we trying to accomplish here? And once you know that, like, let's say the strategy is to, you know, compete for this, maybe you're launching a new feature, or you're trying to, you found that your ICP is always talking about this one particular, you know, use case that they use it for. Well, maybe you want to tackle that first, right? And so once you know that, you can go into the data, filter down by anything that relates to that intent. But the way we prioritize is we effectively say, okay, let's look at we do a balance between what's the total opportunity here, right? That we could reasonably rank for. So we approach it the same way you would do any sort of TAM analysis, a total addressable market analysis. And we say, okay, what's the total opportunity here? What's the value of this? So you have to take into account things like, you know, what would be our conversion rates if people land on this type of content? What's the conversion rate on top of funnel content versus bottom of funnel content, things like that. So we plug these numbers in. If the customer has them, we just plug them in, and then it takes that data plus the data that we've already collected from the cluster. And it also goes and looks to see something I can't like fully divulge here, because this is really like the secret sauce, but we look to see like what's the topical authority, like how well does Google believe that they're already established in that niche. And we use that to order and sort things into a priority. And so the way we actually go and use this is we basically just take all the data, feed it to the algorithm. It spits us out a CSV. We have it in a pivot table, and we pretty much just work our way down from the top. And it's been working phenomenally. So it just does the calculations for us. And what it tries to focus on is where can we get the highest impact with the least amount of effort. So whether that's refreshing an existing page, you know, to bring up, you know, several lucrative keywords from say ranks 7 through 10 up to 1 through 3, or whether it's creating brand new content, it works both ways. So
I assume that as part of the algorithm, that there's some kind of competitor score or analysis that happens as well?
To some extent. So we originally, whenever we built this, we decided to say, like, let's not look at competitors, because we wanted to look beyond competitors. We wanted to actually look at the market itself. You know, and standard sort of approaches, if someone were to do like your typical competitor gap analysis or something like that for SEO, you're always only looking at what your competitors already have and not looking at what have they not even touched yet. Like where's the blue ocean still at? And so we try to look beyond that. But that being said, whenever we do collect all the data, we also like we'll put in a set of competitors that we want to be able to compare to, and we pull in their data as well, so that we can see not only how well are we doing across the entire market from a visibility standpoint, but how well are the various competitors doing across that market as well. We also use that to help identify another score that we have in our output is what we call relevancy. And because when you do pull in a massive amount of keyword data to go process, you'll end up with some noise. It's just inevitable. You know, they're phrases that are synonyms from one another, acronyms that don't mean the same thing, you know, things like that. And so by pulling in competitor data across it, we're also able to sort of suppress more of the noise, because it's it lowers the relevancy score and pushes it down to the bottom of our data set. So it's still in there, we just never really see it.
And you mentioned inputs, and I appreciate, again, there's certain things you can reveal, certain things you can't, so just share whatever you're comfortable with. But I'm really curious, because you laughed and said, oh, we've got a formula for that too. But yeah, it sounded like there is a manual aspect of assessing. You used the phrase total attainable market. Is that correct?
The main manual aspect is actually just getting the keyword data, like pulling it from a tool like Ahrefs, SEMrush, Search Console, et cetera, right? So take all that and you just feed it into it.
Do you feed in manually the potential conversion rates or click-through rates and metrics like that?
Yeah, we can do it both ways. So if we're doing, because not every customer really knows what that's going to be yet, especially if they're, say, a Series A, you know, they haven't quite, maybe they've just now found product market fit or something like that, and they don't really know how well they're going to convert across various stages of the funnel, right? So when they don't know that, we use a proxy. So similar to the way Ahrefs calculates traffic value, they essentially say, you know, what's the volume of the keyword? what would be the click-through rate if it was ranking number one based on this SERP, right? Because you'll have a lower click-through rate if there's a local pack at the top or if there's four ads at the top versus two, right? So they use that to calculate traffic, and then they say, okay, like, and then what's the average and or median CPC for that keyword? And that's how Ahrefs calculates traffic value. And so we do essentially the same thing where we'll say, okay, like, what would be the value of this data, except we can also, like, we pull it in from different sources as well, because Ahrefs doesn't always have all the data. So we'll pull it in from SEMrush and Google Ads Planner to sort of fill in the gaps, and then use a median whenever there's nothing there. So then we can see, if you were to pay for this traffic, what would it cost you, right? And so that doesn't tell you in a predictive sense, like, how much, like, you can't forecast from that and say, here's what the value of this page would be worth. But you can say, you can use it as a proxy to give you directionally accurate data to say, this page is, if we were to buy that traffic, it would cost us this much. This page, if we were to buy the traffic, would cost us 20% more. And you can say, okay, if that's the case, then that 20% more is probably going to be a more valuable page to you. So you can use it relatively that way. But if the customers do have very good conversion data across different stages of the funnel, if they have a more sophisticated analytics setup and, you know, CRM that's, you know, pulling in, especially if they're have any sort of sales motion going on, right, where we can actually know, like, how did things look all the way through the funnel, then basically we process data, get those numbers from them, put those numbers in, and then it'll spit it out for us as well.
I think about the strategist at the receiving end of this information, and the question that keeps going through my mind is then, what is a strategist there to do? If you have the formulas and the algorithm, which essentially helps to break down and deliver topic clusters in a really logical, organized way with all of the key metrics, what's the strategic input that's then required?
I think what it does for them is it frees them to focus more on strategy and less on analysis. So what they're doing is they're thinking about, okay, what are the key important areas of this industry that we do want to focus on, right? And so they're the ones that actually go and to say a tool like Ahrefs, and we'll be putting in things like, I want to find everything related to project management. I want to find it and thinking about all the different ways that you could talk about that, right? You could have task management, like workload management, things like that, right? So they're thinking about, what are the different inputs that I need to provide to these tools to be able to get the data that I need to feed into the algorithm. Beyond that, what they're primarily responsible for after that is being able to understand, when they're looking at the data, like, what makes sense for the business when it comes to their resources, knowing, do they have does that business have the resources to produce the content that's needed for this? Does this business understand the customers, like how much customer research that is? So they spend a lot of time doing customer research, doing interviews with customers, collecting qualitative insights, because we like to take customer research data from, like, one-on-one interviews or chat logs or gong recordings and marry that with the clustering data, so that we can find, where do they overlap? Because having all the data in the world is great. That's fine, right? But if you still have to actually create something with it, and if you create a piece of content that doesn't speak to the buyer, to the reader, then it's not going to do anything for you. Like, you'll rank, but no one will convert, right? So they spend a lot of their time really understanding the business, the industry that it's in, the customers, their pain points, so they can take that data and figure out, how do we angle this? How do we talk about this? How do we, you know, inject personality and empathy into the content when we go to create it? So they're not actually doing the writing, but they're creating the briefs for the writers to guide them, and then, you know, sort of reviewing them and making sure that it aligns with the business's goals.
And so what is the primary obstacle that you face when working on content strategies? I guess I'm not trying to simplify it. Again, not trying to be dismissive by simplifying the process. If you have a really slick process for topic clustering, you mentioned as you were talking that essentially it leaves a plan of action, a prioritized plan of action of the areas to focus on, then it sounds to me like the only limitation in businesses being able to commit to content strategy from that point is resource, is the ability to write fast enough, broad enough, empathetic enough content. Is that the biggest obstacle? Are there any others?
Yeah, I would say that's actually probably the biggest one that remains, and it's a chasm, right? Like, the most companies that we go to work with initially, like, they don't have Like when I talk to the marketing departments there, I'm like, you know, like, what does your system look like to continuously collect qualitative insights from your customers? Either, you know, the content marketing team rarely has that. So the product team does a lot of times, right? But maybe they're a service-based business, in which case they don't really have it. So they're not going to go talk to sales or success or something like that. But it's almost like oftentimes there's not enough customer details that we really want to have. Because they've never done one-on-one interviews in a non-sales environment, you know, just to collect that info. And that's probably like one of the biggest barriers. Beyond that, though, it's resources. A lot of times these companies are working with freelance writers, and we try to encourage them. Like we produce content for some of our customers, but we're very particular. We focus on purely bottom of funnel content. We think that general writers can write the top of funnel for the most part because it tends to be more broad. But one of the problems I see I'm running into there is when it comes to finding, hiring, and retaining good talent. And when they are hiring freelancers, the problems that they run into is that the freelancers will never understand the product as well as somebody internal at that company would. In addition to that, how to position themselves, right? Like whenever they're writing about the content, whenever writing their content, and how they're, whether it's positioned within the market or against competitors. You know, freelancer just doesn't tend to have that. So we spend a lot of our time after sort of putting together the strategy and the plan. We spend most of our time like helping them manage and resource. And those are, like you said, like it's definitely not something I would dismiss because those are like the soft skills, right? That are I can't solve those with an algorithm, right? Like that's when you have to roll up your sleeves and really, you know, get face to face with people and learn to understand them.
Do you think this aspect of scalable content could be partially solved by AI copywriting tools in the future? Is that something you're looking at?
I think it can be solved as long as, I mean, I'm never going to say never, right? I mean, who knows, you know, how advanced things can get. If it can get to the point where it can fact check itself, I think that's like one of its key limitations currently. Beyond that, it's as long as you have a human there currently, say with like GPT-3 with the current models, you still need a human there to guide it. One, to fact check it, to kind of keep it in its lane, to make sure that it flows, right? Like it doesn't necessarily understand, you know, good prose and things like that. But beyond that too, it's also until it can understand the ICP, until it can understand the customers and you and how you're positioned in the market. I don't think that they'll be able to fully automate it, but it can definitely help a writer who knows what they're doing, who knows how to use the tools. It can help that writer be much more effective, just because of all the things that we run into, right? Like I still write, and sometimes you're just looking at a blank page and you're like, all right, how do I start? You know, and it can definitely help there.
How about emerging topics or trends where the keyword research might not exist yet, and you take that data typically from tools? You mentioned Ahrefs. Do you face those challenges with projects for emerging trends, products, services where the keyword research just doesn't exist yet? How do you approach those?
Yeah, that was definitely like a problem in the beginning. And so if you're in an industry that's fairly new, right? Or if you're in a very niche industry where the people don't really search all that much. Well, honestly, if you're in one of those industries, then search probably doesn't need to be the distribution channel that you're focused on anyway. But what we've done there is, you got a few options. One that we found that works very well is to basically extract everything from Search Console automatically. So that's one of the inputs that we give it now as well. So we'll take historical data over the past 18 months from Search Console, whether you rank for it or not, like you'll still get impressions. And the reason for that is because rank tracking tools are checking the top 100 results all the time. And so you're still going to get an impression whenever something gets searched for or like when people are scraping things, right? So you'll pull that. And then another good route to actually get additional emerging things are from things like the PAAs that people also ask, and the Google Auto Suggest API. So we'll pull in that data as well, and then use that to feed into our cluster to figure out where those questions and where those auto suggest terms actually fit into the broader landscape. Typically speaking, they fit into an existing topic that already exists, you know, that they may already have a page for. Sometimes they do break out onto their own though. And at the same time, like we refresh our data, like when we're working with a customer, we'll refresh it periodically. sometimes every 30 days, depending on how dynamic the industry is, sometimes once a quarter or once a year, to see if intent has shifted, because it will shift sometimes. And when it does, you have to go back and potentially combine two pages that maybe have merged over time, or, you know, get rid of a page or split a page into two. So I'd say Google Search Console is a great one, especially whenever. So like one of the things that we do too is when we pull in that data, we have a trending report in ours that will show us what queries begin to spike in terms of trends on searches, whether we're ranking on the first page or on the 10th page, you know. And we can use that as a proxy to say, okay, like this is beginning to trend up. Let's go collect data. I think there would be some interesting ways around, say, we're playing around with it right now. We're just trying to figure out what's the best way to curate it is from Google Trends. But you've got to effectively give it seed keywords and then pull from its like related results. And sometimes those related results that it provides you in from the Google Trends API or not from the API, but through the platform are completely like erroneous and off the wall. So beyond that, though, it's honestly customers. Like that's why we talk to customers, because they will say things, right, that like the keyword research tools just don't have, right? Or where the keyword research tools are showing zero search volume. But then when you go rank for those keywords and you see that people have searched for that, you're getting impressions for it, people are clicking on it. It's just that the tools like Ahrefs and SEMrush haven't even begun to pick them up yet.
Yeah. And sometimes customers, in my experience, they might provide abbreviations or terminology that you just wouldn't think as a marketer or not being in that industry to search for. And that can give you kind of a seed phrase or seed keyword, which you can then go on a kind of journey of discovery and opening up. It opens up the keyword research for you, I think.
Especially whenever you view yourself as one thing and then you realize your customers think about you a different way.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that not only impacts content strategy, that can impact your entire business strategy, right? And you know, either whether it's pivoting your positioning a little bit, if it really resonates, it may help you kind of refine your messaging, or maybe you need to button up your messaging to, you know, if they're thinking about you in a way that, you know, isn't the way that you want them to, right? If they're trying to lump you together with another product when you're really trying to differentiate yourself and things like that.
We've been talking the whole episode and I've been looking at this all through the lens of content and SEO. Can all of these principles in your software be applied to paid marketing as well?
Yeah, it can be applied to Google Ads. I don't know about, I suppose YouTube to some extent, although YouTube's has a very different algorithm, right? Like YouTube primarily relies on the, you know, the related videos is really the big thing. So I don't know that I would use it as much for YouTube. I think what you can do is you can figure out what's popular, what do people care about, what if it's a very competitive SERP, like you can go and make a video for it and probably rank for it instead and get better traction that way. But it does work for Google Ads. So the way that you can think about it there is that, you know, when you're going through adding negative keywords and or trying to find additional keywords to kind of group together into an ad group or an ad set, or even if you're doing skags, that's where if you're, you know, applying negative keywords as well. So single keyword ad groups, when you're applying negative keywords, once you know that one keyword is not good, then you can effectively look at the cluster and say, what are all the other variants and other keywords that fall within that same group? And then just immediately go add them to your negative list. So it can speed up, you know, I guess like refining and testing of which keywords are going to work well. Because the moment you do find one that works, you can also just go find that group and add them to it as well. So it can really, it's more of a saving in terms of budget versus performance, I would say. But it can reduce like the learning time and reduce the wasted ad spend. But search is definitely the best thing that it's made for. I can't really imagine a way that it would work all that well for social. I think you need to have a dramatically different approach to social. So
yeah. Going back to search and in closing for this episode, one thing I was thinking about is how search behavior has changed. And I realized as we were talking, you've been exposed to so many keywords and so many data sets, but also just so many topic clusters. Are there any trends in search behavior that you've identified cross industry when it comes to topic clustering? To elaborate a little bit, so you know where my thinking is going. I remember sort of maybe 10 years ago when we started to get, well, maybe even longer, 10, 15 years ago when we started to get more localized search behavior changed and people started to search for X business near me or X service near me, and near me was the thing that was appended onto the searches. Anything like that that you've spotted?
I think, you know, all the near me terms still exist. I do feel like they're not as used anymore because people are just kind of assumed that the results are going to be local. That being said, I have noticed, this was like anecdotally, across a few different instances where people moved away from using near me to actually using the city, or location that they were actually in because their cell phone tower, would trigger them, would ping them as being nowhere near where they actually were. And so they were getting completely irrelevant results. And so they started refining it, using the city. But beyond that, I would say the largest trends that I'm seeing that are shifting that are really interesting is the Google recently introduced they did this a long time ago though too. So it's back again where they're indenting links, like related pages on a site. They're indenting it underneath the search result. And so what you're finding there are these very nuanced, sort of intents. Like the difference between sometimes even like when people are searching for should I versus should you, right? We're seeing some more nuanced intent that way. I'm seeing things become much more long tail as well. Like people are, whether they're typing out more fully formed questions or whether they're using, a microphone like through like Google Voice or something like that. I'm seeing that, or not Google Voice, but, you know, through the Google search with the text to speech, whatever. I'm seeing that a lot more. And I don't know. I've even seen people like just observing how they search, in person and stuff. The younger generations are typing out full sentences. They're not using like Googleese. I think the way that we were, that maybe like millennials or the older generations were maybe using because Google came along while we were still here. So I'm seeing that a lot more, which is even more reason to collect more data so that you can, see all the different like long tail variations, the ways that people think about things.
That's a great way to close. Yeah. Even it lends itself to the importance of collecting more data, but also distinguishing the data by intent and things like sentiment and everything else that we've discussed in this episode. Scholar, it's been really fascinating to talk through topic clustering with you and learn more about how you do it. If people want to extend the conversation or learn more about you and Ardent Growth, where can they find you?
The best place is probably on LinkedIn. If you search for my name, Scholar Rees, on LinkedIn, you should be able to find me. Beyond that, if you're in the content world and you're not part of Jimmy Daly's from Superpath community, I'd highly recommend checking it out. I'm in there all the time and try to answer any questions that people throw my way over there. So,
Scholar, thanks again for your time. This has been the Internet Marketing Podcast. Take care.
Thanks, Scott.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.